From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan. Terry Gross is on vacation. On today's Fresh Air, Francis Ford Coppola on the 53 minutes of footage he put back into Apocalypse Now and why. Also, what it was like working with Brando and Hopper. Coppola's interview with Roger Ebert was recorded at this year's Cannes Film Festival. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Three Mo Tenors, the upcoming PBS Great Performances broadcast, and a new CD featuring three African-American singers. It's all coming up on Fresh Air.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend, the end of our...
First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. Negotiators in Northern Ireland have extended a deadline for a new peace package. Earlier today, International Arms Monitor said the IRA had proposed a way to put its weapons completely beyond use. Northern Ireland's main Protestant leader, David Trimble, welcomed the IRA Irish Republican Army proposal, but signaled he wanted to see action before agreeing to any deal. The United States today thanked Russia for encouraging North Korea to reopen a dialogue with the South. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
The State Department watched closely as Russian President Vladimir Putin hosted the reclusive North Korean leader Kim Jong-il. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said he was pleased that Putin encouraged Kim to follow up on a promise to visit Seoul.
One of the elements that we had encouraged them to do was to raise this issue of resuming the North-South dialogue. We're pleased to see that they did that, and we see that as something useful that they did.
Boucher repeated the United States is prepared to open a dialogue with North Korea. Kim has not responded. The talks were halted when President Bush took office and ordered a review of North Korean policy. A State Department official welcomed another outcome of Kim's Moscow trip as well. The Russians say Kim promised to stick to a moratorium on long-range missile tests until 2003. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
American Fulbright scholar John Tobin was reunited with his father today in Moscow following his release Friday from a Russian prison. Tobin was arrested in January on drug charges. The case attracted wide attention after Russian security officials said Tobin was suspected of becoming a spy. A Russian computer programmer has been released on bail. The programmer was arrested last month and charged with violating a controversial U.S. copyright law. NPR's Rick Carr reports.
A San Jose, California magistrate ordered Dmitry Skliarov released on $50,000 bail, which was posted by Elcomsoft, the Moscow firm for which he works. The judge also ordered Skliarov to stay in Northern California and set a pretrial hearing date for later this month. The FBI arrested the 26-year-old Moscow programmer after a Las Vegas computer convention. U.S. software firm Adobe Systems had complained that Skliarov had circumvented the anti-copying system Adobe developed for electronic books. Federal law makes it a crime to circumvent copy protection systems, but computer programmers who oppose Skliarov's arrest say that law unfairly restricts the rights of e-book readers and victimizes software developers. Rick Carr, NPR News.
Palestinians are urging the United States to put further pressure on the Israelis. Palestinian officials say a senior aide to Yasser Arafat has sent a letter to Secretary of State Colin Powell. Palestinians want Powell to persuade Israel to stop its assassinations and begin carrying out confidence-building measures. On Wall Street, stock prices were generally lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average off 111 points, and the Nasdaq fell 32 points. You're listening to NPR News. More than 1,000 mourners packed a church in Warren, Ohio today for the funeral of professional football player Corey Stringer. Stringer played for the Minnesota Vikings. He died of heat stroke last week during training camp. Mark Uricki of member station WKSU has the story.
Football fans are looking forward to the NFL Hall of Fame game tonight in Canton, Ohio. But about 50 miles away in Warren, fans, players, and coaches gathered for the funeral of Corey Stringer. Stringer's neighbor and longtime friend, Fred Harris, says the so-called gentle giant was generous to his hometown.
Corey's house was in Minnesota, but his home was in Warren, Ohio. He never left. I mean, we've seen Corey like we always did. You look up and Corey's walking down the street, or Corey's driving down the street, or Corey's knocking on your door. You know, he's at the plaza, he's at the schools. That's why these people are here today. Not what he gave to the city financially, but mainly he gave his heart.
Minnesota coach Dennis Green and player Randy Moss were among those gathered to remember their teammate. For NPR News, I'm Mark Uricchi in Warren, Ohio.
The chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is resigning at the end of the month. Republican Curtis Hebert submitted his resignation in a letter to President Bush. The message was delivered to the White House on Friday. The resignation had been expected amid indications the president preferred Patrick Wood III, a former state regulator from Texas. Damage assessment teams are spreading out across the Florida panhandle after a visit from Tropical Storm Barry. Some areas have been soaked with up to 6 inches of rain, and there are big concerns about flooding. Preliminary reports do not indicate heavy damage, but crews are working to restore power to thousands of panhandle residents. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from White Wave, the makers of Silk, a lactose-free organic soy milk available in the refrigerated section of supermarkets and natural food stores. Silk is soy.
This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Neil Conan. 22 years after it first opened, Apocalypse Now is among the most controversial, most studied, and most brilliant American movies. A new version of the film is playing in New York and Los Angeles and opens in many other cities later this month. Apocalypse Now Redux is 53 minutes longer than the original. The biggest addition is a sequence at a French plantation in South Vietnam that was cut altogether in 1979. Critics say the re-edited and restored version is richer, darker, and funnier. Film critic Roger Ebert first saw Apocalypse Now when it won the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival, and Ebert was in the audience when Apocalypse Now Redux showed at Cannes earlier this year. Afterwards, he spoke with the director and co-writer, Francis Ford Coppola, as part of the Industry in Focus series of the American Pavilion at the festival. Before we hear their conversation, here's an excerpt from the film. Marlon Brando, who plays the renegade Colonel Kurtz, is recalling an atrocity at a Vietnamese village. After American soldiers inoculated the village children with polio vaccine, the Viet Cong arrive and hack off the children's arms.
There they were, in a pile. Pile of little arms. And I remember, I cried, I wept like some grandmother. I wanted to tear my teeth out. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I want to remember it. I never want to forget it. I never want to forget. And then I realized, like I was shot with a diamond. A diamond bullet right through my forehead. And I thought, my God, the genius of that. The genius, the will to do that. Perfect, genuine, complete, crystalline, pure. And then I realized they were stronger than me because they could stand it. These were not monsters. These were men, trained cadres. These men who fought with their hearts, who have families, who have children, who are filled with love. But they had the strength to do that.
At the time we saw it here, and I saw it in the Old Palais, and I think it was my greatest film-going experience at Cannes because I had spine tingling, I mean, literally, I mean, not figuratively, but real tingles. At the time, we were so filled with stories about the production. All the lore about Brando, for example. Now, seeing it again after 22 years, all that's forgotten. It's all water under the bridge. Brando's performance seems so strong to me, and so just on the right note and just handled right by you, and all of the gossip about, you know, how much he weighed or, you know, every time Brando does anything, there are a million stories from the set had all just faded away, leaving this pure and great performance. How did you feel seeing it again? Because you had to work with Brando and deal with him and so forth.
Well, you know, he's an extraordinary man, and beyond as the roles of films that we know, just what he talks about and the way his mind thinks. And it's true, I could tell you so many stories, I don't want to overstay my welcome, but the truth of the matter is Marlon is like a kid, and he's very lazy, and he doesn't like to work, and he also gets embarrassed, and he gets stage fright. So when he arrived, he was very big, and I immediately, in film you always have problems, and part of your job as a director is to see how you can make the problem be an advantage. So I immediately suggested, well, Marlon, why don't you play it as this big fat guy and have one arm around a beautiful girl and another with a mango that you're eating and show him as a man who has surrendered to the jungle and to the lusts of life. But Marlon is very shy about his weight. He says, no. He says, I can't do that. I don't want to be like fat and stuff. I said, okay. Well, I couldn't have him be, as it was written, a kind of Green Beret colonel in uniform because, where would he have gotten the uniform that could fit him, So the idea I had in movies, very often you're looking at the actor from the waist up. And in a movie, if you're broad, if you have big shoulders, even like Roger, if you're broad, that in your mind, you assume him to be a big man, a giant. Not necessarily heavy. So I thought if I shot him from in that attitude, and then when I showed him full, had a double who was like 6'6", it would make Kurtz be like a giant man rather than like me, So I that was the philosophy I took as a solution. The second issue was that Marlon, I wanted it to be like the character Kurtz in the book. And Marlon immediately said that would never work. So when an actor has a problem with the script, you talk about it. So every morning I would go into this houseboat that they had for Marlon, like a trailer, and I would talk about, since that the Kurtz idea from the book wouldn't work, that perhaps this would work or that work. And Marlon talked and talked and talked and talked and talked. And they'd knock on the door and said, okay, everyone, what should we do? It's time for lunch. Is it go to lunch? And then we'd talk and talk and all through the night. Even they say, knock, knock, it's time to go home. And we did that for 5 days. And I realized suddenly, Marlon only had a deal for 3 weeks. And what he was doing is he was getting out of working. And he was conning me. And that at the end of the 3 weeks, he was just going to leave. So finally I started getting... well, why won't it work? And, blah, blah, blah. One day, the fifth day, I come in and I'm astonished. There he is, and he's cut off all his hair, which is the image of Kurtz from the book. And I said, Marlon, what happened? They says, you're going to do it like Kurtz. He says, yeah. I said, I think doing it like Kurtz is the best way. I said, but you told me that wouldn't work. You said you read the book and it would never work. He says, well, I didn't read the book. I said, but you told me you did. He said, well, I lied. So that's like what it is to work with Marlon, but his instincts are so great that, and many of our talks led to opinions and ideas that I would write down, and just as I did with the French people, I would prepare like the basis really sort of from some of his monologues, and that was the basis of really those scenes he had. And Vittorio finally said, Francis, look, let's just get him up there in the dark and we'll do something with the light. And Marlon immediately got it. And he used the light in his first scene as like a prop. He kind of poked his head out a little. You saw a little, then he poked it in, and then he put the water. And so there's sort of a method to his madness. And I would have to say, for all of his shenanigans and stuff, that it was what he brought to it that led to the way he did that performance. And in his instinct, he knew that it had to be dished out in little razor slices and that it had to be done with great mystery. And so I do think he did a wonderful performance, and that the ending, which as you know, which was considered sort of like very obscure, that was the right ending for Kurtz, and the sentiments that he gave about that horrible story of the children with the polio arms and
that story is the fulcrum of the entire movie.
Yeah, I mean,
showing that their will is greater.
Right, and
it says it was brilliant. It's genius.
It was that's all from Marland. We work as the way you do with actors, where you give
even him the story about the inoculations is from him.
No, that was one of the things that in those 4 days, you know, in a funny way, Marland was stalling, but he didn't know how to do it, and through those talks, in a way, he came to know how to do it. So that's the artistic process, really. And he evolved what he needed in order to do that performance, and he's to be commended.
It's just right, because when you get to this legendary character in the Heart of Darkness, you really don't want to just have him standing there like a person who exists in the same dimension as the other people in the film. He has to emerge out of some other kind of idea, I think.
Well, he also knew. Marlon even said to me that you've painted yourself into a corner, haven't you? And what he meant was that as I made the film going up the river, I was making it more surreal, you know, with the colored smoke and the style it had, and by making it more surreal, a normal Guns of Navarone ending wouldn't have worked anymore. So I had painted myself into a corner, and I didn't know how to get out. And he knew that I had done that, and I think he likes to kid around and stuff, or he's a big practical joker. But I think that early process of trying to find the ending was his working really at it.
Another performance that seemed much more correct, or just seemed just right to me now, was Dennis Hopper's. And at the time we saw the movie originally, I think there were all kinds of echoes of Easy Rider, and it was almost like his drugged out photographer was, you know, the guy from Easy Rider making a guest appearance in this movie. Now, everything has faded into the past enough that it can be seen as an original character, and it seems like just right. You need somebody to explain things, and you don't need Walter Cronkite there to explain it. You need somebody like this who has, you know, found his own madness in Kurtz's jungle.
You know, I didn't have the script with me when I made the film. I just had this paperback copy of Heart of Darkness, thinking that whenever I was in a scene or situation, I would double-check Heart of Darkness to see what wisdom Joseph Conrad would give me, you know? And in Heart of Darkness is a wonderful character, if you remember, the Russian, who is this character very much like the role Dennis Hopper plays. And we literally put that Montagnard jacket and put the cameras, because I had heard of, I think it was Errol Flynn's son, was a photojournalist in Vietnam and was supposed to be an extraordinary character, and we sort of fashioned the Dennis Hopper character out of nothing, right, out of Dennis and out of the Heart of Darkness. So that character hadn't been in the script and pretty much was, you know, when I say improvised, what you do is the actors take a shot at what they're doing, and then at night I would go home and try to organize it into a scene and bring it back and, you know, slightly more defined. And so that character was done that way.
Francis Ford Coppola speaking with Roger Ebert at the Cannes Film Festival. We're going to continue after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our onstage interview with Francis Ford Coppola and Roger Ebert about Apocalypse Now Redux.
Before I talk about this version in a little more detail or ask you about it, I want to just maybe see if we can settle one thing that has been kind of dogging this film for a long time. When you were here in 79, you said something about, and what you said has always been in contention, you were not sure about the ending, or you didn't know if it worked, or you didn't know if you had the right ending. And then you showed one version in the Old Palais and another version on the Rue d'Antibes with different endings. And then I remember I was out at your house in August of that year, and you said I should have never mentioned anything about the ending because I was talking about very minor things. And, of course, all the critics who went to see the movie spent the last hour saying, has the ending started yet? Is this what he's talking about? Does it mean everything with Brando, or does it mean And your position was the movie was substantially exactly the way you wanted it, and it was a very minor thing that got blown completely out of proportion. Maybe you could explain that, because I think there are still people who don't understand that.
Yeah, it really never had more than one ending, and if to the extent that I said about that, it might have been the level of whether we cut it off a little earlier or let it gone on a little longer. I'm not even sure. The real issue of the ending, though, I believe, is this, that the movie, you know, the Kurtz, the Angkor Wat temple that we built there in the Philippines, we really built that. And it was not safe. It wasn't built to be there permanently. So we were required by the state to remove it. And we thought, well, let's blow it up since we have to remove it, and we'll get a lot of cameras, and we'll shoot it. We'll shoot it with infrared film. We'll shoot it, you know, high speed and every way, and we'll get beautiful footage, and maybe we can use it in the movie. When the film came out, the exact correct version, there are no credits. It's in a program. But when the film, even now, is going to be shown in many theaters, they can't afford to give every theater a program, so they'll put the credits on the end. That happened in this occasion. And when we put the credits on the end, we thought, well, why don't we use that beautiful footage of the temple blowing up? It would be very decorative and nice, you know. And however, because there was in the story the idea of an airstrike, everyone felt that the ending with the temple blowing up meant he called in the bombs and blew it up and probably killed all those people, which was something I didn't want. So I said, oh, my God, that was a terrible mistake. No one takes it as a decorative graphic. They take it as another ending. So we removed it and put it on black and put the words. Well, because of that, to this day, the notion of this two endings persists. And then that's why we removed that. And on the DVD, you can see those explosions with some beautiful music. And in fact, my voice telling the story of the two endings. So to set the record straight, there really was only one ending. And partly it was because at the end of the story, when Willard sort of goes through this enormous ritual sacrifice of Kurtz and sort of becomes the new leader, I had him throw away the weapon. And if you notice, they all throw away their weapons. And it was my hopeful way of saying that it could end not with a bang, but with a gesture of peace and of hope that we will, you know, not always have war through hundreds of years into the future. So the ending of the explosion was something that went against that more pacifist desire, and that's why I wished it wouldn't be.
And you, by just being sincere and open and honest, you let this genie out of the bottle that distracted, I think, a lot of viewers and critics, because they didn't know what you meant by it.
It's hard to know what will stick, though. You know, certain ideas. Yeah, there's this idea, I guess it's in the notes, that we were looking for a place to put the French plantation, which I don't recall, because the French sequence happens after Larry Fishburne is killed and they bury him, so it's the only place it could be.
Well, let's talk about the additional footage. Could you enumerate... although we all kind of know what's new, but if you could just kind of talk about it in terms of what it is and why it was sort of left out.
Time was the big reason, but also the idea that we thought to be successful, which is to not be designated a flop and to earn our money back, that it had to qualify as a war action adventure film. And so we also thought that perhaps some of the things we took out were bizarre or sort of left turns. They fall into four categories: the French plantation, the Marlon Brando reading the Time magazine, the playmates, the young girls, and in that rainy medevac, and I guess those are the big ones. And then there were many sections that were just lifted to make the film move faster, which is so stupid that we did it, but the consequence of the napalm of the surfing, the idea that in order to let these boys surf, he orders the napalm to be dropped, which ruins the wind so they can't surf, which is sort of a comment on so many of the things that even were done in Vietnam. So the French sequence I always loved because it gave a historical perspective, and also it supported the idea that when they leave the bridge, they're really going, they leave civilization behind and they're going back in time. At first they go into the 50s where the ghosts of Indochina War are still there, and then when they leave that, they go into prehistoric time, which is where Kurtz is. So I very much liked the French plantation, but because of the way we worked with the French actors, I like to rehearse, and I always ask the actors to suggest. And so they brought up many political issues of the real things that were argued about in those days in that they heard in their family. And so I kept writing the script using their suggestions, and the script got longer and longer, and the French sequence became quite a long sequence. And I said, well, maybe we can make it shorter. But every time we made it shorter, it seemed to lose its point. And so it didn't work, and then ultimately we cut it out. So Walter Murch, who hadn't worked on that part of the film when he was the original editor, because we had more than one editor, he said, I'd like to just cut that scene as though I'm just getting the film from the director. And he cut it in its full sense, and it seemed to be a very interesting historical perspective and show how so much of the French experience had 15 years before, you know, they had students marching in the streets and protests just as America had, and America hadn't learned from such a clear example. Plus it had the added notion of colonialism that really the French were fighting in Indochina because, you know, their grandfathers had settled these plantations, and it was really, they thought of themselves of living there. It wasn't just fighting for some empty political chess game that the leaders had done. So the French sequence seemed to be valuable, but in the early cut, when it was short, it was just another episode to get through before yet another demanding one, and so we eliminated it to, you know, in film we have the theory. We have many theories, some of them contradict, but one theory is that whatever you remove from the film makes what's left better. And often that's the case. But I always tell my kids that when you cut out anything you want, throw it on the floor and just try to cut to the point, because it will, on the floor, it will say, put me back in. And the ones that nag you the most, you put back in.
Francis Ford Coppola and Roger Ebert on Apocalypse Now Redux. We'll hear more in the second half of our show. I'm Neil Conan, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publishers of Deborah Tennant's new book, I Only Say This Because I Love You, How the Way We Talk Can Make or Break Family Relationships Throughout Our Lives. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a seasoned filmmaker looks back at his work as a young director. We continue with Francis Ford Coppola's interview from the Cannes Film Festival. Also, three Mo tenors. Lloyd Schwartz reviews the PBS broadcast and CD featuring African-American tenors. This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to the conversation between Francis Ford Coppola and critic Roger Ebert after the screening of Apocalypse Now Redux at this year's Cannes Film Festival.
I reckon that the attack on the village with the helicopters and the Wagner and so forth is just simply one of the best movie scenes ever made. I mean, it just comes together as just stunning. You sit there in awe. On paper, did it look that way? I mean, you must agree with me that that scene really, it does it. It does whatever a scene can do.
Well,
that scene does it.
It seems astonishing to me that I thought at that time that, oh, well, that's no problem. We'll just do that, you know. Now that I look at it, I say, my God, how did we attempt it, you know, because obviously we had to build the entire village and then we had to destroy it with these helicopters and photograph it all with people. So it seems to me a feeling I have about the difference between being young and old, or the young filmmaker and the old filmmaker. The young filmmaker is very insecure, you know that. Very insecure, very unsure of himself, doesn't think that he really has the goods. The old filmmaker is very insecure. The young filmmaker is stupid, which is to say doesn't realize that how difficult some of the things that he's going to attempt is, and the old filmmaker is experienced. And to be stupid is a great advantage, because that sequence could not have been done by someone who wasn't stupid, you know, who wasn't, you know what I mean, doing something that wasn't really practically, you would have knocked that down and made that simpler. And in answer to your question, that was John Milius's scene in the original script. It was a dazzling scene, even in the script. He based it on true information that they would play music. They call it PSYOP, psychological operations, to kind of unsettle the people and make them fear what was about to happen. And it was a dazzling scene in the script. But of course, when you direct a scene, you go in and you make many, many vignettes that you invent, which are not in the script, like, you know, the fact that there's a Vietnamese school and the children hear the music and run away, or that there's a helicopter evacuation that a sapper blows up. In other words, what I do is I go in with little index cards, sort of like with The Godfather. You have a wedding and you're going to introduce the characters, but then you make a lot of specific vignettes. Oh, there's a little girl is going to be dancing on the feet of the uncle, or and so you have these index cards, and then you all meet and you say, okay, well, let's do the index card 3, you know, and then you stage, and then when you put it all together, you have the points of different interest that makes up the thing. So that's how you do it.
One more question. I remember talking to Carl Malden about On the Waterfront, and he said there was a scene in there that was the hardest scene he'd ever been asked to do as an actor. And it didn't even involve dialogue. If you remember, he's in the hold of the ship and somebody throws a beer can at him and hits him on the head with it. He said the hardest thing he ever had to do as an actor was to act as if he didn't know he was about to be hit with a beer can. Now, Duvall has to act as if he doesn't know that bombs are going to be going off right behind him and all around him. I mean, because he's totally oblivious. In other words, he's impervious. Nothing can hurt him.
Right.
But as an actor, I mean, the character, that's fine for the character to be impervious. But for the actor to be able to keep that tone exactly even when you're blowing up explosives 15 feet away from him must have been kind of difficult.
Well, actors love to work that way, which is to say, from the script, there was the idea that that kind of guy probably will die in bed as an old man, that he's not going to get hurt. So we discussed, and as a decision, we said, look, there's going to be lots of bombs and explosions going off. You play it like you don't even notice it, and then everyone else will be, you know, cowering. And, you know, one thing, of course, they were going off, and as a deliberate decision, he was not paying attention. But don't forget, in the movie, a lot of the real sound is put in later, so some of those explosive sounds maybe weren't as loud. But it showed the discipline that he had as an actor. You know, that was his intention, and he did it. I'll say one little quick anecdote, if I may. we were in big trouble on the movie right from the beginning. You know, some of the history, another actor was chosen, and very good actor, and I made the decision that that it wasn't the right casting, and we changed that. I was really in the deepest worry that I could be. And the day that I had the first hope was the scene where we had three or four cameras going, and the idea was that these three, four jets were going to fly over and drop these canisters, and then a mile of napalm was going to go off, and they were going to play a scene, and this was all going to happen once with three cameras, you know, moving on dollies and stuff. So we attempted this, and we only had the ability to do it twice because that napalm drop that was a mile of flame took the way it was done. I won't bore you with it, but we only had the chance to do that twice. So when we were ready to do that, you know, they had to send the jets from some other Air Force base, and they had a time, and they had to drop it, and the actors had to all be ready, and the bombs had to go off and not kill anyone, and they had to play a scene. And so we did it, and I watched, and it all happened, and the flame went off, and I realized that we didn't have to do it a second time, that the one time sort of had worked. And that was the moment in my heart when I said, I'm going to get through this. Just, you know, how, like, the first time I had the feeling it would be okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thanks a lot.
Francis Ford Coppola spoke with Roger Ebert at the Cannes Film Festival. This was part of the Industry in Focus series at the American Pavilion. Coming up, more with Francis Ford Coppola. This is Fresh Air. Today, we're talking about Francis Ford Coppola and his movie Apocalypse Now Redux. Terry Gross spoke with the filmmaker in 1997.
I'm interested in some things about your family. I think it was your maternal grandfather who actually owned several movie theaters. What years did he own them? Were you alive?
No, this would be really in the 20s, I would guess. And in fact, they not only owned some theaters, and theaters that catered pretty much to Italian-American audiences, but they lived on top of it, and so all the family would have different jobs. My grandmother would take the tickets, and the younger, mischievous brother, Victor, you know, people in those days used to put their babies in the lobby, and so that he would walk through and say, baby crying, and, you know, they would really run these little theaters. And then from that, he actually began to go to Italy and acquire some films for Italian-American distribution in his company. Also, he did music roles, because primarily he was a songwriter and a composer, and a wonderful one, I think. And his music role company was called Paramount Music Roles. And some of his friends in that time, in the 20s, were involved in becoming involved in a movie studio. And as the story goes, they were talking to him and looking for a name, and he suggested, we'll call it Paramunto. And that was Balaban and Katz, who later were the partners in what later became Paramount.
That's quite a brush with early movie history.
Well, I have on the other side another interesting story. My other grandfather, Carmine Coppola's grandfather, Augustino, was a very fine engineer and tool and die maker, made mechanical things, and he was called upon to engineer and build a new device that turned out to be the Vitaphone, which was the first sound talkie movie that when they made The Jazz Singer with Al Jolson, it was, and there's in our museum, there's a beautiful museum in the winery, and there's a picture of him with the Vitaphone that he's just built.
Can you sing a verse of a song that your grandfather wrote?
Well, sure, I'll always sing for you. In The Godfather, there was a whole sequence in a little Italian-American music hall where they sang a song that was called Senza Mamma, and it went sort of like, Senza mamma, a quanta foresta parola ancora, senza... It's all about crying because he ran off with a sort of a woman of no account, and then his mother died.
So that was your grandfather's song?
Yeah.
Well, that's great.
That's a Neapolitan song.
Huh. So I think it was your grandfather who gave you, a 16-millimeter projector when you were a boy?
That's right. In the 49, I had polio, and I was paralyzed for a year, and he did bring me, a kind of 16-millimeter projector. It was a young people's projector. It wasn't it was a real working 16-millimeter projector, but it was, of toy quality, but I used to certainly love that.
So what did you project in it?
Well, unfortunately, because it was 16-millimeter, there were only the couple of little film clips that I had. Most of what film I could play with was an 8-millimeter, and there I had a number of cartoons and some home movies. And also my father had one of the very early tape recorders, the Ecor home tape recorder, and I had it by my bed when I was in that period of being paralyzed, and I used to try to make soundtracks and synchronize them to make them play in sync with the movies.
And what would be on the soundtracks?
Well, it would be stuff like, "Ah, here we go, yeah, da 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 da. Hey, Mickey, no, watch out, the fire." It was like that.
So how paralyzed were you?
Well, I couldn't walk, and I couldn't move my left arm.
So you spent a year basically away from the rest of the world.
I was in a bedroom on the second floor. You know, in those days, people were very, very frightened of polio as a children's contagious disease, so I didn't certainly see any kids. I saw my brother and my sister, and I had a television. One of my great frustrations, of course, this is before remote control, was that I wasn't able to get up to change the channel. But I had my favorite shows. There was one called The Children's Hour that Horn and Hardock used to do with lots of talented kids singing and dancing. And I loved that and some puppet shows.
So did you have any sense at this age that you actually were getting serious about movies?
No, I didn't have a very, important view of myself. I was, I had been always moved many, many schools, so I always kind of was a little bit of a loner, and I had an extraordinarily talented and, really a kind of winner older brother who was very kind to me but pretty much was the star of the family, and so I never thought of myself as I wasn't good at school, and I wasn't particularly as, my family was very good-looking, all of them, and I was the affectionate one. I wasn't as good looking as the others.
It must have been interesting for you to eventually go from, being paralyzed for a year alone at home in your bed to, being such the center of attention and so famous.
It was totally an accident. It happened because I was a little bit of a boy scientist, and I was very interested. I used to stay by myself in the basement or the garage, whatever. Since we moved a lot, whatever little shop I could set up, and it was my interest in science and electricity, and that got me kind of working on lights and on theater. And then I think my older brother was a writer, and because of him, I heard about things related to literature, and I pretty much wanted to emulate him. So the combination of being interested in stories and literature and lights and theater and I must say girls, because the girls were at the theater department or the football team.
Right.
So I wanted to, I always was a little bit of an outcast socially because I was the new kid. And I felt if I could hang out at the theater, and of course theater always needs volunteers, and if I was willing to, work and unravel the cable or help build the sets, I could be included in the group.
Your father, Carmine Coppola, who wrote music for The Godfather and for the restoration of Napoleon, was, a professional musician throughout his life, and certainly, while you were growing up. He was a flutist with an orchestra. He played for a while with Radio City Music Hall, accompanying the Rockettes. What were some of the things that seemed really exciting to you about his work?
Well, the most dramatic part of that period as a child was that he was the solo flutist for Toscanini and the NBC Symphony Orchestra. So all during the time that I was a small child, it was a very prestigious, and we were occasionally there'd be articles in the newspaper about him, and so we knew there was something important going on. Although when I was really little, I used to go around telling everyone that my father was a magician because I had heard he was a magician, but I got it wrong. He was a musician. I remember one incident that is very vivid in my mind. They took me to the studio and Studio 8H, where the big orchestra and Pasquinini with his white hair and black turtleneck was, and I was brought as a five-year-old in a little glass booth, and I was very intrigued because there was a knob in the booth, and when you turned it all the way to the left, you would hear the orchestra, and when you turned it to the right, you couldn't hear the orchestra. I think that's when I first realized as a concept that sound and picture are not necessarily connected.
Two of your movies have been war movies, Patton and Apocalypse Now. Were you ever drafted?
No, but one of my school experiences was at a military school. I was at New York Military Academy in high school for a couple of years, and of course I played in the military band. But I was a full out cadet, and so I knew a lot about, you know, really in a funny way, cadet life, which of course was a place up there right next to West Point, and I was very good at drill, and I knew all about military organization and stuff like that.
So you liked it.
I did like it. After a while, I felt a little isolated there when an older roommate graduated. He was someone who was, you know, reading James Joyce's Ulysses, and he was a kind of pretty interesting fellow. He was also the only Jewish guy in the school, and I admired him. And then the next year, I kind of felt very isolated and wanted to do interesting things with the theater group there, and they didn't want me to, and I finally ran away.
Ran away from school?
Ran away from military school.
Oh, my gosh. Were you caught?
Well, I did it very effectively. I just called a cab.
Well, what happened?
I wandered around New York, scared to go home, because my father was on the road with a Broadway show, with a touring show, and I wandered around New York, and I had sold my uniforms to some guy whose brother was going to come the next year, and I had a couple $100s, and I sort of lived this very strange wandering around New York and seeing things I'd never seen before. And then when I got home to where my brother was living with his wife, I told him what had happened. He said, "Here, read this book." And I read The Catcher in the Rye, and I said, "Hey, I just did this." I wrote a letter to J.D. Salinger after reading it, and I said in the letter, you know, I'm 16 and I want to be a filmmaker, and I've just lived something so much like your book that I know I would do a good job. I wish you would please let me have the rights to make Catcher in the Rye.
Oh, that's a scream. I'm sure you got a lot of response from J.D. Salinger.
Yeah, zero.
Yeah.
Terry Gross spoke with filmmaker Francis Ford Coppola in 1997. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews Three Moe Tenors, the PBS broadcast and CD featuring African-American tenors. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. First, there were three tenors, then three Irish tenors. Now, three African-American performers, known as Three Moe Tenors, are featured on a PBS program airing this month. They also have a new CD. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz recently went to a Three Moe Tenors concert in Boston. He has this review.
African-American women singers didn't have it easy getting into opera. Marian Anderson broke the color barrier at the Met only in 1955. Since then, there's been a steady stream of superstars, from Leontine Price to Shirley Verrett to Jesse Norman. Black male singers have had an even harder time. And though things are changing, they're changing slowly. The telecast and CD of Three Moe Tenors attempts to remedy that situation, though the versatility of the three stars gets more emphasis than actual opera singing. And frankly, only one of them excels in opera. The tenors are Roderick Dixon, Victor Trent Cook, who was nominated for a Tony Award in Smokey Joe's Cafe, and the marvelous veteran Thomas Young. He's so admired by contemporary composers like John Adams and Anthony Davis that numerous roles have been written for him, sometimes even more than one in the same opera. He was chilling, for example, as both black Muslim spiritual leader Elijah Muhammad and a seductive hustler named Street in Davis's Life and Times of Malcolm X. Three Mo Tenors mixes opera with Broadway, sizzling jazz, blues, soul — the tenors do a terrific send-up of Gladys Knight and the Pips — gospel, and spirituals. Crammed into an hour, the TV version doesn't have quite the free spirit exuberance that got the small but wildly enthusiastic audience singing and clapping along when the tenors kicked off their tour in Boston. Still, it's an entertaining, relatively ungimmicky hour. Even watching the rehearsed participation of the audience at New York's Hammerstein Ballroom is fun, though it's not as much fun as actually being there. While opera gets short shrift, the shadow of one of the original three tenors, Luciano Pavarotti, looms especially large in the programming here, beginning with the inevitable three tenors version of Verdi's most famous tenor aria.
La donna è mobile, qual fiume al vento, muta d'accento e di pensiero. Sempre una amabile, leggiato rovviso, in bianco in riso, è menzognero.
La donna è mobile, qual fiume al vento, muta d'accento.
There's also Pavarotti's theme song, Puccini's Nessun Dorma, which Young sings with an unshowy seriousness, and the aria with the nine high C's from Donizetti's Daughter of the Regiment, the one that first brought Pavarotti to international attention. Roderick Dixon sings it accurately, but not without effort. He's no serious competition for the master. His strong voice is well suited for Broadway, though. The one show song left in the telecast is the high-minded but sentimental anthem Make Them Hear You from Ragtime, which Dixon appeared in.
The lyrics of the next song echo the sentiments of African-American tenors, past, present, and future. Go out and tell the story, let it echo far and wide, make them hear you, make them hear you, how justice was our battle and how justice was denied. Make them hear you, make them hear you, and say to those who blame us for the way we chose to fight that sometimes there are battles that are more than black or white. And I could not put down my sword when justice was my right. Make them hear you. Go out and tell.
Victor Trent Cook, more a countertenor than a tenor, is most at home singing in a jazzy falsetto. His rendition of the spiritual Were You There is too over the top to feel genuine, but his live wire, zoot suited, hip swiveling impersonation of Cab Calloway in Minnie the Moocher is a showstopper.
Hello! How you doing, New York? We're so happy you came out tonight. This is a song made famous by the late, great Cab Calloway. A one, a two, a one, two, three, and. Now here's a story about Minnie the Moocher. She was a low-down, a hoochie-coocher. She was the roughest, toughest frail, but Minnie had a heart as big as a whale. Hidey, hidey, ho!
Hidey, hidey, ho!
Hidey, 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 hey!
Hidey, 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 hey!
On stage, Three Mo Tenors was primarily, and rightly, a showcase for Thomas Young's phenomenal versatility. He's the real artist. On TV, he's more like one of the guys. There's still a glimpse of his wide range, though, which encompasses, along with opera, America the Beautiful, astonishing scat, and his own arrangement of Annie Ross and Wardell Gray's Deranged, Twisted. Three Mo Tenors is the brainchild of Marion J. Caffey, who starred as Jelly Roll Morton on Broadway. His official bio says he is now, quote, completely dedicated to conception, writing, and directing. I hope his future conceptions include lots more Thomas Young.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and director of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He reviewed the Three Mo Tenors CD and their concert, which is being broadcast this month on the PBS Great Performance Series. For Terry Gross, I'm Neil Conan.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Tell No One by Harlan Coben, a novel of suspense. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the first true geological map and the extraordinary story of the humble engineer who made it. We'll talk with Simon Winchester about his new book, The Map That Changed the World. I'm Neil Conan. Join us for the next Fresh Air.